I'm William Cooper, and once again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we continue with part two of our series on the life, the presidency, and the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. I encourage you to call them and tell them that you're a steady listener to William Cooper and the Hour of the Time. Ask them for a current newsletter, chock full of information that you need to know about non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets, precious metals, and all of their various forms. We encourage you, ladies and gentlemen, to place at least a portion of your assets in real money. Please call Swiss America Trading right now. Don't procrastinate, and ask them how you can put together a program to acquire some real money to protect yourself, your assets, and your family from what we know is sure to come. Sit down, ladies and gentlemen, and realize that just in this year alone, the stock market has increased over 1,000 points. And see if you can find in your own mind any justification for such an increase. And then call 1-800-289-2646 and do what you know you must do. Look around at the faces of your loved ones. Can you, right at this moment, assure them that you have taken the necessary steps to protect them against a financial catastrophe that could happen, could occur at any given moment? If not, you must make this call. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be so, so happy that you did. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, part two in our continuing series.
is its inner sanctum. At the end of the ganglia of wires that run from this console quivers the power of America, from thermonuclear striking force to missiles in the deep. Whoever in lonely responsibility must press one of these buttons does so for all the American people. When he moves to create or destroy, he speaks his conscience and theirs, for they have freely chosen him. In the 172nd year of their republic, the American people sought to give this responsibility to a new leader in that rowdy transaction of passion, tumult, and circus called a presidential campaign.
The people of the United States in this last week have finally caught up with the promises that have been made by our opponents. They realize that it's a modern medicine man show, a Pied Piper from Boston, and they're not going to go down that road.
I run against a candidate who reminds me of the Civil Rights Party, the circus outfit, the smooth colonizer. A long memory and no vision, and you have seen elephants being led around the circus ring. They grab the tail of the elephant in front of them.
It was invisible, as always. High in the hills of New Hampshire, as the clock passed midnight, the citizens of Hart's location gathered to fit together the first fragments of the mystery. Before the clock came round again, 68 million other Americans would join these first 12 voters to give the answer. By dawn tomorrow, America's power would pass to new leadership. Yet who it was to be, no man could say. It was 8:40 that morning when the candidate arrived at the West End branch of the Boston Public Library to cast his vote. Here in the 11th Congressional District, where he had won his first political victory, he signed in the basement of the library, John F. Kennedy, 122 Bowdoin Street. His education for power had begun 43 years ago. Born in the First World War in a gentle suburb of Boston, schooled at New England's finest halls, he had as a Harvard junior visited England and watched, with his father the ambassador, the decay of English power as Munich approached. Then tasted war himself in the far Pacific. Peace had brought him back to Boston politics, to the United States Senate in 52. Peace had graced him with a new bride, led him to an examination of history and heroes in a prize-winning book. Spectacular re-election to the Senate urged him on to the presidency. Now, home again, after 2 years' pursuit of ultimate power, he must wait the judgment of his fellow countrymen. Far across the continent, his rival, too, had returned home. Whittier, California was crowded now with the curious, gathering to see Richard Nixon cast his vote in Precinct 33. In this quiet town, a Quaker village, he had been born 47 years ago. He returned now as Vice President of the United States. A sensitive lad, a good student, Dick Nixon had gone from Whittier schools to Duke University, then off to war in the Pacific, then home again to run for Congress. A buried pumpkin, Alger Hiss, a strip of hidden microfilm, combined to make young Congressman Nixon famous, led him to the Senate in 1950, sped him to nomination for second highest post in the land under Dwight D. Eisenhower. As Eisenhower's heir apparent, Nixon traveled the globe, debated with Nikita Khrushchev in Moscow. Nixon offered Americans experience and the magic stamp of legitimacy. For Nixon, this was the end of a long road, a road whose tributaries begin in the secret places of men's hope and ambition, long before it descends to public view in the pageantry of open politics. A road that invites men on into history and immortality. It was a crowded road in the fall of 1959, as political leaders examined seven men in whose dreams might shimmer the tall pillars of the White House. On the Democratic side were five candidates. Stuart Symington of Missouri, national defense specialist, was the politician's favorite. Yet many waited for word from inscrutable Adlai Stevenson, most distinguished of Democrats, but a two-time loser. Certainly Lyndon Johnson, master of Congress, would run. But the Southerner had no big city appeal. Hubert Humphrey was going, but could he transfer his Minnesota power to other states? Finally, John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Brilliant, glamorous, but young. Among Republicans, Newcomer Nelson Rockefeller, a smashing vote-getter. But was he too new, too rich, too liberal? And, of course, Richard Nixon. Each man's life had already long since been reshaped by presidential ambition. But to speak such yearning too early is forbidden by the code of American politics.
I still believe that it's too early to make a decision with regard to 1960.
Why have you chosen to become the first announced candidate?
I don't need no announcement.
I'm not a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
Well, you said many times you're not a candidate. But so would you accept this
rant? You wish me to say it again?
Senator, Massachusetts prefers you as an aspirant for the presidential nomination, are you?
That's the senator's statement, not mine.
Informed sources have said you'll make your decision by November.
I have no schedule. I've made a decision at the present time that I'm not a candidate.
These matters, which so occupy the attention of those in political life, really are not matters of general concern until the primaries finally come.
Finally, politics must be brought into the open. The Republicans hold the White House. In midwinter, two Democrats, Hubert Humphrey and John Kennedy, announce their claim. Kennedy is off first to an uncontested primary victory in New Hampshire. But his mortal battleground will be those spring primaries where Humphrey challenges him. No other way to nomination is open for either man. Next July, the Democratic Convention will choose the candidate. But Humphrey and Kennedy fear that the big city bosses may cut their hearts out in convention back rooms. Kennedy, because they think a Catholic must lose. Humphrey, because they think him too liberal. So these candidates must now appeal to the people. And their first clash comes in the Wisconsin primaries. Here on the winding roads of the Badger State, Kennedy, a stranger from Boston in cold prairie country, must joust with Humphrey to political death. Lonely as a stick on the street corners of chill Wisconsin, Kennedy reaches for hands to shake, hearts to win, and for votes. Votes are power. Only factory gate grassroots votes delivered at primaries will give either Kennedy or Humphrey the strength to buck the bosses at convention and win the nomination. For Humphrey as for Kennedy, the same grueling tasks wait. Everywhere his bus stops, Humphrey calls on his Midwestern neighbors of Wisconsin to reject this elegant stranger, the Bay State Senator. From over the borders of his home state, Minnesota, come weekend volunteers for his modest headquarters, serving his cause with earnest, folksy zeal, passing out cards that give Muriel Humphrey's recipe for black bean soup.
It's been Mrs. Humphrey and myself. You see, I sort of feel like an independent merchant competing against a chain store when I compete with the Kennedy family.
From a large, well-staffed headquarters in downtown Milwaukee, Kennedy workers efficiently divide Wisconsin into its 10 convention districts. They are trying for a knockout, a victory that will entirely eliminate Humphrey. Bobby Kennedy directs the most skillful team of political operators since James Farley, Captain Franklin Roosevelt's troops. The Kennedy women arrive, first Ethel, then the senator's sisters, then his wife, too, adds her efforts. Now, in the streets, as the end draws near, the crowds begin to grow. Elation mounts, and Kennedy men predict victory by 7 districts to 3, then 8 to 2, then 9 to 1. By election morning, as Democrats vote in the Wisconsin primary, some even predict a clean sweep, all 10. Listening to these words on a radio in his third floor suite at Milwaukee's Pfister Hotel, studying the shape of the vote, Kennedy knows early in the evening, first, that he has scored no knockout. Secondly, that politicians everywhere will see the vote as a reflection of religious cleavage. What is happening is now clear. The industrial cities with their Catholic working men are giving the Massachusetts senator a decisive margin. But the 3 westernmost districts of Wisconsin, agricultural and Protestant, are voting heavily for Humphrey.
Humphrey is leading now in the front of the vote, but Kennedy appears to be closing the gap.
For Kennedy, this is a victory without joy. Though he wins 6-4, he still has not proven his vote-getting ability in Protestant districts. In a Milwaukee television studio, Humphrey is as cheerful as Kennedy is downcast. Humphrey has expected a trouncing. This upset is almost a victory for him. Exuberantly, he prepares for the next round, the West Virginia primary. Kennedy men feel otherwise, that Humphrey, having lost in Wisconsin, has lost all and now should quit. As he flies to West Virginia, Kennedy must face the moment of truth. He must prove that religion alone will not decide elections in America. And he must do it in a state whose people are 95% Protestant. If he loses there, he loses all. And the 1960 convention will choose a candidate in the back rooms. As Kennedy arrives to take command in Charleston, West Virginia, he finds his organization already installed and fresh reserves arriving from New England. Bobby Kennedy goads the team into high. Pollster Lou Harris arrives to probe the tides of prejudice. Direct from Wisconsin to marshal the field workers has come Larry O'Brien. And Press Chief Salinger is now on a 20-hour day. Against such formidable opposition, Humphrey's major problem grows more acute every day.
It doesn't make you feel very happy when the man walks into your room at 5:30 in the morning and says, "Senator, we're in debt $18,000 and we have no more money for anything. No money for television, no money for printing." I say, "Where are the buttons? We have no money." So I say, "All right, we'll just knock off the whole day, cancel out the program, and we'll get on this telephone. I'll call my friends in Minnesota, we'll call them in New York, we'll call them in Washington. We've got to raise the money."
From beginning to end, Humphrey's campaign echoes America of another day, of the old populists, of the warm, visionary early New Deal. He was the poor man's candidate, and in West Virginia, with its thousands of unemployed miners, Humphrey hoped for a response.
Humphrey is a senator, a neighbor, a friend. We're going to stick with him all the way to the end. He used to come over just to help us out. It's our turn to help him without any doubt. So vote for Hubert. Hubert Humphrey, the president for you and me.
Kennedy's problem is religion. The two elegant Kennedys, with their polished East Coast accents, their grace of dress and daring, seem alien in West Virginia. But nothing seems more alien than their Catholic faith in this overwhelmingly Protestant state. Staff planners debate the problem. Finally, acting with his closest advisor, Ted Sorensen, Kennedy decides to bring the issue into the open. There is no test of faith or religion when a man is summoned to die for his country. Why should there be a test of faith when he tries to serve it in peace? So speaks Kennedy, but no one can read from the intent faces of the West Virginians whether this plea reaches their heart. On May 10th, West Virginia votes. It will be late before the ballots give the answer. A Kennedy sweep by 60-40. The walls of prejudice have fallen. At 1 o'clock, at his headquarters, Humphrey speaks for the last time as candidate.
"Now, I am no longer a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. I shall run for re-election to the United States Senate from the state of Minnesota. I shall do whatever I can, however, to make sure that the Democratic convention will adopt a liberal platform and nominate liberal candidates who will be elected in November. And to that end, I shall be in constant contact with my friends in Minnesota and throughout the country." That's my statement. I want to thank all of you, too. You've been very good people.
Can we ask any questions, Senator?
No.
First man out in the 1960 sweepstakes. Humphrey is a glow of devotion in all who followed him. But presidential politics have little time for losers.
America, America, and the people. country road on the wind it comes to call. And it sings in the farms and the factory towns and the weary days they've eaten no song at all. And the words are the words that our fathers said and they whistled down the years. And the name of the song is the name of the dream that's music to our ears. America, America, and the dream.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. Their specialty is non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets, real money, if you will. And if you've received your copy of Veritas, issue number 8, you'll see that the original coinage act begins on the front page. You'll begin to understand what real money is. And if you have a copy of the Constitution for the United States of America, you will see, if you read it carefully, that money, ladies and gentlemen, is coined. And it is, in fact, silver or gold coin. If you don't have any real money, you are flirting with disaster. Because this inflated, phony stock market that just yesterday went above and stayed above 5,000 points for the first time in its history, and in fact, in just this year alone, had exceeded a 1,000-point increase. When our base of manufacturing is leaving the country to exploit cheap labor in third world countries, where is this increase coming from? How do you account for it? If you were to take these companies and dissolve them tomorrow, would the net worth of all of the assets of those corporations equal the worth, or I should say, equal what has been paid for the stock? The answer, ladies and gentlemen, is no. Not by a vast margin. This has to come tumbling down. It's artificial. The value is not there. And when the value does not exist, eventually there has to be an adjustment. And in this case, it's going to be a terrible, drastic adjustment. So I urge you to call our sponsor, Swiss America Trading, today. Tell them that you're a steady listener to William Cooper in the Hour of the Time, and you will receive red carpet treatment. Ask for your copy of the current Swiss America Trading newsletter. Thank them for sponsoring this broadcast and explore the methods whereby you may be able to develop a program to protect at least a part of your assets with real money, precious metals in their various forms. I highly recommend coins. Call now, 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. A great weight will come off your shoulders when you know that you don't have to worry about that portion of your wealth that you have placed under the protection of real money. 1-800-289-2646. Tell them William Cooper sent you. That's 1-800-289-2646. Call them.
Forgot his words, all the struggles and the sorrow. If we you see the children, a sky full of hope, and a flag that's filled with stars.
America, America, and a dream.
Devotes to good old-fashioned politicking with big city eastern bosses. To Pennsylvania, to powwow with grizzled Governor Lawrence. To Chicago and Dick Daley, boss of Cook County. To New York and Bob Wagner at Gracie Mansion. To New Jersey and Governor Robert Minor. To Michigan and friendly Sophie Williams. The primaries have won him delegates. More than that, they have won him the prestige to turn to these northern power brokers and demand the great blocks of delegates they control at convention. Yet American destiny is moved by more than grassroots politics. 12,000 miles away, an American U-2 is brought down over Russian soil, and Khrushchev's short temper snaps. The summit conference of 1960 explodes with his tirade against America.
И будете опять готовить нападение, мы так ухнем, что больше не будет слушать.
The outer world in these spring weeks seethes with violent threats. Africa is liberated. The Congo approaches self-government. And as the world is jolted with spreading new tensions, the Democratic Party re-examines its youthful frontrunner. At the end of June, Harry Truman puts the question directly to Jack Kennedy.
I want to say to him at this time, and I quote a statement to Senator Kennedy, Senator, are you certain that you're quite ready for the country, or the country is ready for you? In the role of president in January 1961.
In these turbulent weeks, Democrats seek another candidate.
That's right.
But thousands of other Democrats turn almost by instinct to the party's most eloquent spokesman on foreign affairs, Adlai Stevenson.
You know, Chairman Butler this afternoon recognized you as a candidate, and he said that your people, at least, are going to be allowed to have office space in the Biltmore Hotel. Does this change your feelings?
Well, I hadn't heard about that. That's news to me. My people are going to have office space in the Biltmore?
That's right.
Well, I didn't even know I had any people until I got to Washington. Anyway, bless all my people.
Hitherto, Lyndon Johnson's campaign had been a mixture of country music and congressional maneuver. Now, Johnson counts on his record as seasoned majority leader of the Senate to give him the image of leader for a time of crisis.
Senator Kennedy, with the convention just
less than 2 weeks away. How do things look for you?
Well, things coming along very well, I hope.
But the nomination, which had seemed close enough for Kennedy to touch in May, is to be a matter of bitter contest in Los Angeles in July. Los Angeles glistens as starting July 4th weekend, delegates, alternates, candidates, hopefuls, wheeler-dealers stream in. The sports arena waits for the Democratic Convention. But at the Biltmore Hotel downtown, the real business, politicking, has already begun. 761 is the magic number. 761 votes needed to nominate. The lure or snare wavering delegates, headquarters have been opened by each candidate. Symington hopes he'll win his compromised candidate in a deadlock. Lyndon Johnson has a solid block of 400 Southern delegates, but little support from elsewhere. 9 miles away, Adlai Stevenson on convention eve still refuses to ask a single delegate's vote. But Stevenson has tremendous emotional support in the party. His followers hope that Johnson leaders will add their delegate strength to a Stop Kennedy movement that will halt Kennedy on the first ballot and rip him apart on later ballots. As front runner, Kennedy is the target of every whisper, rumor, counterplan of his rivals. Yet, in the noise and babble, Suite 8315 at the Biltmore, the Kennedy command post, remains serene. Someone calls this convention the changing of the guard. A new generation is replacing the old. The battle-tested veterans behind these doors are almost all in their 30s. Unflustered, they direct the Kennedy organization in a round-the-clock effort. Great national conventions always break up into small meetings of state, regional, and special interest groups. All these meetings are stirred by a simple purpose: to find the leader the party can offer the nation and win. As caucuses seek a man, the candidates seek out caucuses, addressing 10, 20 groups a day. Entering the last intense weekend of caucusing before convention, Kennedy feels reasonably certain of 600 votes. Three key states can add the votes needed for nomination. But Illinois, Pennsylvania, and California have not yet made up their minds. Kennedy efforts will concentrate on these. The Kennedys have courted Dick Daley all year. He controls Illinois' 69 votes. On Sunday, he caucuses Illinois behind closed doors, and it breaks 59 for Kennedy. Monday, Kennedy pleads for Pennsylvania votes. By noon, Governor Lawrence announces 64 out of 81 for Kennedy. The bandwagon rolls as the convention officially opens that evening. Up to now, it's been Kennedy all the way, and his count has passed 700 delegates, only 60-odd shy of nomination.
Is now called in session. I have the honor and the proud privilege...
Stevenson's planners explode a surprise. They have flung a chain of wild enthusiasts around the arena. They hope they can trigger a stampede to halt Kennedy. Next day, Tuesday, Kennedy meets Johnson before a joint meeting of the Texas and Massachusetts delegations. All other caucuses pause to watch as the majority leader contrasts his working record in the Senate with that of his campaigning rival.
For 6 days and nights, we had 24-hour sessions. 6 days and nights, I had to deliver a quorum of 51 men on a moment's notice to keep the Senate in session to get any bill at all. And I'm proud to tell you that on those 50 quorum calls, Lyndon Johnson answered every one of them. Although some men who would be present on a civil rights platform answered none. Admittedly, I didn't have the problem that some of my people had of opposing Senator Humphrey and Morris in four primaries. Senator Johnson, let me just say that I appreciate what Senator Johnson had to say. He made some general references to the shortcomings of other presidential candidates, but as he was not specific, I assume he was talking about some of the other candidates and not about me.
it is true that Senator Johnson made a wonderful record in answering those forum calls, and I want to commend him for it. I was not present on all those occasions. I was not majority leader. As Lyndon knows, I never criticized. In fact, on every occasion, I said that I thought Senator Johnson should not enter the primary, that his proper responsibility was as majority leader, and that if he would let Hubert, Wayne, and I settle this matter, we could come to a clear-cut decision. So I come to you today full of admiration for Senator Johnson, full of affection for him, strongly in support of him for majority leader, and I'm confident that in that position, we're all going to be able to work together. Thank you.
Next Tuesday afternoon, Stevenson comes to the convention. He finds the contagious excitement of his volunteers sweeping the delegates on the floor.
Where is Dr. Delegate? I'll find out in just a moment now what the cause of this excitement is and pass the word on to you.
The reservoir of affection for him floods over. A tumult rocks the delegates. They know this pressure cracked the California delegation today when 33 California votes broke for Stevenson. Can Adlai be drafted? Many delegates waver. Should they hold back from Kennedy and wait for Stevenson's call?
After getting in and out of the Biltmore Hotel in this hall, I decided that I know who you're going to nominate. It will be the last survivor.
Setback hits Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson favors the headline. The next day, Wednesday, Stevenson volunteers circle the arena again. They flood the gates, pack the galleries, prepare to stampede the convention. Nominations begin when Sam Rayburn offers Johnson's name.
I present to your man, who has demonstrated that under adverse circumstances...
During 4 hours of nominations and demonstrations, the final struggle for votes goes on. Bobby Kennedy and Abe Ribicoff, the Kennedy floor leader, command 40 floor workers by a net of 8 direct telephones and high-powered walkie-talkies. Squirming among the delegates, they plead, urge, cajole for individual votes. They must pick up 20-odd votes for their man. Finally, the calling of the roll begins.
Alabama cares. Johnson, 20 votes. Kennedy, 3.5.
Johnson listens from the Biltmore. Alabama, a southern state, gives him first lead. As the roll continues, Stevenson finds that for all his emotional support, nothing shows in hard votes.
Massachusetts cast 41 votes. John F. Kennedy.
Secret hideaway, Kennedy marks his own tally sheet. The big city states are coming in as planned. Even New York, where a reported Stevenson revolt
occurred. The delegation. Senator Kennedy, 104.5.
Bobby has told his men that if the 700 mark is passed when the state of Washington votes, they can win. That mark is reached.
Kennedy.
Next. West Virginia and Wisconsin, both safe, one in the primary. Wyoming can give them 763 in victory. Teddy Kennedy rushes to Wyoming.
Wyoming vote will make majority to Senator Kennedy.
Screaming police escort, Kennedy speeds from his hideaway to the arena. Outside, governors, mayors, senators, bosses gather to form a protective escort for the young new leader. Tomorrow, in an all-day tussle, he must choose a vice president. But tonight is for jubilation. He now commands all the machinery of the National Democratic Party. These 80 chieftains must march to his direction.
convention, it is not possible for me to give you an answer to your nomination until Friday night. But I think you can guess what the answer will be.
In Washington, Vice President Nixon, apparently certain of nomination, is disturbed in June by rumblings in his own party. As the Republican convention approaches, Nixon's chief concern is the man he wanted as vice president, but whose friend him, Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller, attacking Republican leadership, wants much greater effort in national defense, bolder foreign policies, advanced civil rights. His demands provoke deep resentments. A clash looms between liberal and conservative Republicans. And Chicago will be the arena. The Windy City, most famous convention gathering place in American history, prepares for the 2,600 Republican delegates and alternates with its usual efficiency, precaution, and pretty girls. Already at early hearings to set the party platform, fighting breaks out. Rockefeller people press for a bold program. Conservative Republicans hold back. Platform Chairman Charles Percy tries to compromise between the two wings, but fails. Rockefeller's staff men at the Sheraton Towers Hotel, deadlocked in the platform committee, are willing to risk an open clash over national defense and civil rights that can rip the party apart. Friday, they receive Rockefeller's permission to threaten open floor fight. That afternoon in New York, Rockefeller will get a telephone call from Washington. Nixon wants to fly to New York privately and visit him. Rockefeller will agree. An hour's flight will bring the vice president from Washington to New York. Nixon must head off a conflict in which Republicans will denounce each other. This could only serve Kennedy. Driving into the city, Nixon faces a dilemma. Can Rockefeller's platform demands be satisfied without upsetting the grassroots Republicans in Chicago who remain unaware of this secret rendezvous? He will arrive at Rockefeller's home, 810 Fifth Avenue, at 7:30 of a summer evening. Over dinner for an hour and a half in the triplex apartment, Nixon will urge Rockefeller to be his vice president. Rockefeller will refuse. They will then go on to discuss the platform. Hours later, when they work out an agreement, they will telephone Chairman Percy in Chicago. Below them in the dark, the lights prick out the crinkling vistas of New York Central Park. For 3 hours, by long-distance phone, Rockefeller and Nixon will tell the platform chairman what they decided here. Shortly after 3, Nixon will leave to return to Washington. By morning, the newspapers have the story, and Nixon confirms it.
But on the great issues of national security, of foreign policy, and domestic policy, we found basic agreements, which was expressed in the statement that the governor released in New York after I had approved it.
In Chicago, the news reaches the platform writers. Their indignation boils over at this apparent dictation by two absentee leaders. Senator Barry Goldwater voices their anger.
The unprecedented last-minute attempt to impose upon the Republican Platform Committee platform provisions from a point 1,000 miles away from the convention has caused deep concern on the part of conscientious Republicans attending the convention at Chicago. A great many working Republicans here in Chicago as delegates to this convention are now asking if we come to Chicago to nominate a candidate for the presidency, or is our first concern to tailor our entire platform and adjust our historic principles in order to accommodate the conditions laid down by Governor Rockefeller as prerequisite to his becoming a candidate for the vice presidency.
I think it's a surrender to Rockefeller.
Richard and Pat Nixon arrive in Chicago Monday morning, July 27th, opening day of the convention, and are met by cheering partisans. But these ringing cheers cannot solve the problem of angry delegates who feel themselves humiliated. Nixon must go before the platform committee and plead for party harmony.
What is a party platform? Well, it's something when you build it that can't be so narrow that just a very few can get on it, because then you aren't going to have a two-party system in this country. You're going to have fragmentized parties with everybody having his own little platform with the very few people that he thinks agrees with him on everything. I have heard some people say, if I don't get what I want on this civil rights thing or on this health thing or the rest, I'm going to go home and I'm going to sit it out. Or if I don't get what I want, I just got to go vote for the Democrats. And my point is this, how stupid can you be? If the Democrats in Los Angeles with the differences that they have between the two Democratic parties, or three, however the case may be. If with the differences that they have, and if after what Johnson said about Kennedy and Kennedy said about Johnson, those two could get together, then certainly we Republicans can all get together.
Nixon is at his best in Chicago. In a supreme effort, he lobbies leaders and delegates with his message. They must preserve party unity. He both charms and compels the party. By Tuesday, the revolt is over. The compromise platform accepted. Wednesday is happy to go for the party. The smiling lion of the party, Dwight D. Eisenhower, arrives. Ice power comes from the heart and love of common people, and the streets are choked to feelings. This is the greatest living vote-getter.
The bumper cover that way. Please, lady, don't forget the Guns and Go Boom. Hey, Jack, look who's here. There's our pioneer. Hey, she's loud and clear. Everybody's got the right to be happy. Say enough, it's not a tough as it seems. Don't be scared, you won't prevail. Everybody's free to fail. No one can be put in jail for their dreams. Free country, sing your dreams and come through. Be a scholar, make a dollar. Free country means they listen to you. Cream and holler,
grab them on a collar.
Free country means you don't have to sit.
That's it.
And put up with the shit.
Everybody's got the right to the sunshine.
Everybody.
Not the sun, but maybe one of his teeth. With man, poor man, black or white. Kick your apple, take a bite. Everybody, that's all tight. You're free.
Ladies and gentlemen, from Annie, Little Pooh, Tiny Allison, Mike and Sharon Aponte, and me, William Cooper, a very wonderful Thanksgiving to all of you. Good night, and God bless you all. Gentlemen, the Hour of the Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. Tapes of the Hour of the Time can be ordered in studio quality stereo format. Tapes are $10 for non-members, $8 for members. Make check or money order payable to Annie, A-N-N-I-E, and address your envelope to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. This address will be repeated at the end of this program.